it could. Its decision made, the massive gills on the sides of its neck flared one last time, and then sealed up as Jormungandr transformed itself into an air breather. It leaned forward and then abruptly flinched, as if punched by a titan's fist. A strangled shriek erupted from its mouth, and it shuddered from its head all down its sinuous length before going still and rigid and falling backward into the sea like strange scaled timber. The surviving sheep bleated the ovine equivalent of,
"Did you see that shit just now? I'm never going near the ocean again, no matter how green the grass is."
And the sea sloshed and hissed as the world serpent disappeared beneath the waves. Yes! That deserved a fist pump, for Lakshya had succeeded. She had left Matini's mind, shot through the ether, and executed a hostile takeover of Jormungandr's brain. She had no doubt simply shoved its spirit out entirely, as she did in her earliest years whenever she felt like using a new body. To prevent Jormungandr from settling back in, however, she'd have to occupy that brain and defend it until it died. And once it died in the water, she'd die too. Creatures of the ether don't do well in the water. But Lakshya had just willingly sacrificed herself to save Ireland, minus a few sheep, and she went with a lighter heart and soul than I'd ever known her to possess. It was one hell of a good deed, and a counter to Loki's plans he could not have anticipated. That it also happened to save my own personal potatoes was beside the point. I'd be putting it all on the line before the day was through. And like Jormungandr, I fully expected to exit this life via the unexpected, and people would find my body as they find so many others, staring at eternity in surprise. I felt prepared for most everything I could think of, but what kept my mind racing at night was worrying about what I hadn't thought of. Because just as I had managed a quick and abrupt removal of a key chess piece from Loki's board, the god of mischief and lies had no doubt prepared some surprises for our side. He had never expected someone like Lakshya to get involved, and I had only vague ideas of what to expect when I got to Sweden. But if I'm honest, I did feel a bit giddy and self-congratulatory in that moment for thinking of a solution to Jormungandr's rise that would benefit everyone. I might have even succumbed to the urge to quote some Shakespeare. I squatted down next to Matini, entirely too pleased with myself. Ligarius said in Julius Caesar, "Now bid me run, and I will strive with things impossible, yea, get the better of them." But he never did anything like that, did he? Matini stirred, and her next words were not in English but Hindi. Fortunately, that was a language I knew, though I had few reasons to speak it in recent years.
"Where am I? Ireland?"
"Yes. Welcome."
"Who are you?"
She frowned, and her whole body tensed. "You can call me Atticus or Connor, whichever you prefer." She breathed out in relief and relaxed.
"Good. Lakshya said you'd help me."
"And so I will." Matini sat up. Her voice, while obviously using the same set of vocal cords that Lakshya had used, possessed a slightly different timbre. A softer edge to it. Or perhaps it was the different language we were speaking, I'm not sure.
"Lakshya said she was trying to prevent the end of the world, but it might still happen in spite of her. Is that true?"
"Yes, both things are true. She did her part, but it still might happen."
"I see."
She looked down at Lakshya's ruby necklace around her neck and brought her slim fingers to it, considering, or perhaps silently praying. I let her take all the time she needed, and it was only a couple of minutes before fingers dropped away and she looked up at me.
"Well, thank you for being here. I didn't ever think I'd get to see the sun again, and even if it's only for a little while, I'm glad I have this time. It's good to have a friend at the end of the world."
Chapter 9. I spare a worried glance at the swarming cloud of demons erupting from Seven Star Mountain, and then look at my bubble tea, which the Monkey King insists I must enjoy right now. "I don't know, Wukong. Maybe the demons are more important. I can always try bubble tea later.
Nonsense. Live in the present, Granuaile. Presently, my copies can take care of the first wave, and your bubble tea should be at its peak deliciousness.
The Monkey King had sent an impressive number of clones to join battle, and he seemed unworried, but his eagerness for me to try this tea is making me worried in turn.
Is there something in my tea?
Yes!
He flashes his teeth at me in triumph, excited that I finally figured out something important.
Little pearls of tapioca.
It's just a bit weird that you want me to drink it so badly.
It is merely pride in my work, and it is the right action to take in this moment.
I'm not sure I agree with his priorities. But then, looking again as the red and gold clones meet the swarm and immediately have a visible impact, even from this distance, I doubt my participation in the fight would make much difference. Why am I here? Wukong chuckles, throwing his head back in unrestrained glee.
A philosophical question. The answer is simple. To learn and to grow.
No, I mean, why am I here right now? The Buddha cocks his head at me and shrugs.
The answer is the same, and will remain the same days and months and years hence.
Flittish catches my eye.
Learn well, Granuaile. I must leave you now.
What? I thought you said you had to be here.
I had to bring you here, and I have. I am needed in Japan. Farewell.
Okay. Yeah. Flittish doesn't wait around. She's climbing down the fire escape before I can even finish saying goodbye, leaving me with Sun Wukong. He waggles a bushy eyebrow at me and grins, nodding at my bubble tea.
Oh, fine, whatever. I'm trying it, okay? Look.
I take a sip through the almost absurdly thick orange straw, and it's slightly sweet, slightly floral tea with milk in it. Light and lovely and...
Whoa!
One of the tapioca bubbles rockets into my mouth, and it's mildly chewy and a perfect complement to the tea.
Eh? Hmm?
The Monkey King smiles as he watches my face. He so clearly wishes me to flatter him that I smile back.
It's good, Wukong.
Yes, it is good, and it can be enjoyed in so many different ways. That is the basic tea you have there. So much else for you to try?
I suppose.
Good!
Sun Wukong reaches a finger up to his ear and plucks at it. Something like a small toothpick grows and spins in his hand until it's a long golden staff. He crouches down and holds the staff in both hands.
Now we fight.
What? Is all I can manage. Because I didn't realize, before that moment, that tea could be a prelude to battle. His only answer is to launch himself toward me, staff held high to crush me from above. I throw the bubble tea at him, and he spins in midair to avoid it, while I bring my staff up crosswise over my head to block his strike. The impact shudders through my arms to the sockets of my shoulders, and I stagger back. The Monkey King lands and promptly ducks under my counterstrike as he tries to sweep my legs. I hop over that and lash out with a kick, but he somersaults away. I pursue because the one rule of fighting someone this powerful is that if they start something, you need to be the one finishing it and doing so quickly, because the longer you delay, the less chance you have of winning. Sun Wukong cackles as he tumbles and somehow deflects every one of my strikes with his staff. When we run out of roof, he finds his feet and launches himself over my head, knocking away my thrust at his abdomen, and sticks the landing behind me as I whirl around to face him.
My turn,
he says, and then he's on the attack. I manage to parry the first 5 strikes or so, but after that he gets through my guard every other strike and lightly taps me instead of destroying me, a masterly show of control. He backs away, leaving me flustered. And smiles again as he stands next to his staff, held upright in his right hand and resting on the rooftop.
Bubble tea is good, but as I mentioned, there is more than the basic flavor. Would you like to learn more?
Yes, I am always ready to learn more.
Good.
You have the right mind. Very well. You have been trained in techniques that date back 1,000 years, and you also have some modern moves.
I nod once, because that's accurate. Atticus came to China in the 11th century and received the bulk of his Eastern martial arts training then, which he passed on to me.
You are, in fact, a master by any mortal measure. I do not intend to demean your skill in any way. That must be understood.
I understand. He nods in acknowledgement before continuing.
But there are older techniques, some newer ones, and some that are my own invention.
He flicks a finger to the north.
What you see happening at Yangmingshan right now is the work of only the first and weakest of the Yama Kings. It hardly requires my attention, but there will be 7 more, each deadlier than the last, and you need to be prepared if you are to survive and fulfill your purpose.
So many questions churn in my head. Primarily the question of what he thought my purpose was here, but other things too, like what kinds of horrors we would be fighting, and if I was going to fight an actual Yama King, or merely hundreds of his minions. Yet none of these is important next to the fundamental truth of his statement, so I quash the questions and store them for later. I agree, I tell him.
So if you are willing, let us begin your advanced training. From now on, you will call me Sifu-san.
I bow to him. I am willing, Sifu-san.
Chapter 10. Once Xi'an leaves, I get out of the river and dry off my feet because that water is feckin' cold. Colder than the welcome of a nightclub bouncer on a Friday night. Which reminds me I still owe an arse-kicking to that lad in Kilkenny who threw me out of the pub. I go sit on the edge of the back porch, feet resting on the turf, and let the elemental know I'm available to help should I be needed anywhere. Starbuck, the Boston Terrier, comes out and sits next to me, his mouth open and tongue lolling out. I connect to his mind so I can hear if he answers me and say, "You're a good lad, aren't ye?"
"Yes, food."
He says, "Ah, still learning your language then?"
"Yes, food. Play?"
"Maybe. That word can mean different things, I've learned. What do you consider to be play?"
"Stay!"
he says, and disappears through the plastic flap in the side of the house that Xi'an says is a doggy door. He bursts through it a moment later with a knotted piece of rope. He drops it by my side and looks up at me with his tongue out.
"Throw, please! Yes, food?"
"Throw it, ye say? It seems like a strange request, but I don't see the harm in it. Dogs like Starbuck didn't exist in me own time, so he's a new creature to me, and I'm interested in what he'll do next. I pick up the rope and chuck it a good distance toward the river, taking care not to actually throw it in there. The wee lad springs off the back porch faster than I expect.
"No, squirrel!"
he practically shouts in me head, and for a moment I worry he's gone daft. But once he reaches the rope, he picks it up and shakes it before galloping back to me with it in his mouth, and then I understand. He's practicing his squirrel slaying, and that's play for him.
"Good human,"
he says as he drops it by my side again.
"Throw, please."
I can't help but chuckle at that. "You know how to train humans already, don't you?"
"Yes, food. Throw, please."
I oblige him and think while he's off to fetch that maybe an animal companion wouldn't be so bad, if the werewolves would be okay with it. Before Starbuck can return for another go, a shudder runs up me leg as the elemental speaks to me through my contact with the earth.
"Avenging druid needed. Bavarian Alps. Urgent."
Elementals didn't used to talk to druids like this. The earth hadn't been so feckin' cocked up before, so I never had occasion to hear what elementals called me until I came forward in time. And I really didn't like that name because it referred to an episode in me early years with a dodgy man in a bog, and I didn't want to be reminded of it. Harmony, I reply, but then add, except for name, please call me Ancient Druid.
No, you are Avenging Druid. Hurry, Bavarian Alps.
Bollocks. I go, I says, and hop to me feet. I have to go inside and ask the British lad where in the world the Bavarian Alps are. Once he pulls up a map on his computer and shows me, I figure I can shift to something tethered there and then ask what trouble's brewing in the tea kettle. Sorry I can't play anymore, I tell the wee Starbuck, mind to mind. I've been called away to serve Gaia. Play later?
Yes, food! Good human!
I sprint out to the boundary, shift planes to Tirnanog, and then spend a while trying to figure out which tethers lead to the Bavarian Alps. There are about 10 of them, I reckon, and right as I settle upon one, it disappears, snapping out of existence. Then the one next to it does the same thing. Something horrible must be happening there to disrupt the tethers. I choose the one that's farthest from the destroyed ones and pull myself along the tether, arriving with a bit of panic in me mind, afraid the tether will snap mid-transit. I don't rightly know what would happen to me if it did, but I don't want to find out. I do make it through, though, and soon find out what's been causing all the ruckus. The earth shakes underneath me, and it's no mild trembler either. It's a serious shake-up in progress, and it's gonna ripple out to populated areas soon and disrupt far more than a few tethered trees. But the trees and these mountains, gods below, they're gorgeous! I wish I would have visited before there was a feckin' earthquake in progress, because it's a stunningly beautiful place I've come to. If I didn't know better, I'd say the landscape was trying to have some soft, hot sex with me eyes. It's that seductive. Tuya, one of me apprentices, loves trees, especially. She'd find this place so magical that the corners of her eyes would leak happy tears. Best be about preserving it, then. Druid here to help, I tell the elemental Bavaria. Its reply is less than polite.
You are not Druid. He is elsewhere. You are Avenging Druid.
I blink a few times. This elemental is in the throes of an earthquake where all its living things are in crisis and it's quibbling over names. Query. Emergency?
Creatures disrupt Earth. I will create path. Slay them.
That's straightforward enough. Query. What creatures?
Follow and slay.
Is all the answer I'm given before a fissure opens before me. Not an accident of the earthquake, but rather something with a purposeful floor to it, with walls and a ceiling that remain sturdy even if they shift, no matter how violent the earthquake gets. Bavaria won't let it crush me while I'm on my way to do its bidding. The tunnel delves quickly, and I have to cast night vision to see. I also put on my brass knuckles, and remember that even though I've been given a mission, I can't use a direct binding to kill anything. It's the law of Gaia herself. She judges no death so long as one never uses her power to accomplish it. Druids have been doing her dirty work for millennia now. Or Sheahan has, anyway. Mostly it was demons from this hell or that, but occasionally something fey or more sinister would require his attention. It's not too long before I can't see a feckin' thing, even with night vision cast. You have to have at least a wee bit of light to operate, and underground it's darker than the inky anus of a sleeping octopus. I let Bavaria know.
Continue,
it says.
There will be light soon.
I stagger on, a hand outstretched to keep track of the wall, and stumble a couple of times since I can't see the ground shifting and it surprises me. But I don't want to fail in this, whatever it is. The light shows up soon enough. A dim orange glow and some heat along with it, and a sulphurous odor punching me lungs. That light source is lava. A bit more dangerous way to light up a space than those fancy twisty light bulbs you see these days. And it really shouldn't be this close to the surface. The Alps aren't a range of dormant volcanoes. They were formed by the collision of tectonic plates, which means something nasty is bringing this up on purpose. I hear it before I see it. Cruel laughter, mixed in with throaty chanting in a language I don't recognize, and it's pretty clear I'm spotted first because I have to duck a red glowing rock thrown at me head. It still glances off me left shoulder and sears a groove there, singeing hair and cooking an ear as it passes. I trace back where it must have come from, and there's a wee shadowy thing standing in a rivulet of lava like it's nothing but a cool stream. It looks like it's practically chiseled out of coal or volcanic basalt. All sharp edges, even though it has a humanoid form. In the darkness, it's just another slice of shadow until it moves, and it's moving to scoop up another lava bomb. It has a face like someone took an angry shite and placed it on top of a neck. Or maybe it's just me own anger I'm projecting onto it. I know what this thing is now, attaching it to a description Sheehan gave me. It's a feckin' kobold, but a bloody dangerous kind, and not the weak things I've seen when Sam and Ty, the leaders of Greta's pack, are playing this video game they like. In the game, kobolds are weak creatures with a wee knife, easily slain. But that's not the kind of creature that spawned horror stories from German miners hundreds of years ago. If you're a brave lad tunneling through a mountain, you're not going to be terrified of something with a knife when you have a pickaxe. No, those miners had reason to be afraid, because kobolds can move the earth and collapse a mine or pick up handfuls of magma to hurl at druids' heads. I cast camouflage and wink from his sight just as he looks up to target me again. Then I speed up, watching me feet so I don't step in that lava stream and feed him a fist of brass knuckles between the teeth. I half expected to take his head clean off, but kobolds are as rugged as the mountains they live under. Some of his teeth chip and shatter, and he's definitely knocked senseless, but it doesn't kill him. You can't handle the heat and pressure of the earth's crust without being a tough bastard, I guess. Still, he drops that handful of molten rock and falls backward to the opposite side of the lava flow. Me job's not done. Bavaria wants these things dead, and I know there have to be more, because the quake continues, so I have to figure out how to punch through something with natural defenses like rock. It's neither practical nor efficient. I hop over the lava flow and stand next to the kobold's head, kneeling down to take a closer look. His eyes are not impregnable, I see. Deep set and wee, but they're still eyes made of blood and jelly, nestled in a socket with a hole at the back. I take off me clothes, shape shift into a red kite, and place a taloned brass-coated foot on his face and squeeze, punching into his brain through his right eye. He twitches a couple of times and goes still again. I shift quickly back to human because the heat's getting to me feathers. I'm gonna need a better way. I tell Bavaria that's one down, but I need something to help it go faster. I picture what I need, and it wells up from the earth at me feet in a matter of seconds, a foot-long spike of smooth, polished stone. Lead me to the next, I tell Bavaria as I pick it up. I leave me clothes behind since I may need to shapeshift again soon. The tunnel, I noticed, has stabilized quite a bit since I took out the first kobold, but as I continue on and draw closer to the next target, it begins to shift and buck again, and I fall twice because the light is still none too good. I also start drawing power to heal me burnt shoulder because it's screaming like 10 seagulls fighting over one fish. The tunnel Bavaria's creating breaks through into a new cavern, and a fresh gust of sulfur fumes slithers down me gob like all the ghosts of me bad ideas. I cough and wheeze and tumble down into a roll as I enter, just in case there's an ambush waiting for me head. It's a good thing, too, for a few hunks of rock that qualify as boulders sail over me and crash behind. I find the kobold responsible standing in front of a wall of lava. Me face is already baked dry like those feckin' nuts they give you on airplanes with a sad thimbleful of water. But I'm gonna have to charge him and that wall to end this. And unlike the first lad, he's not chucking those boulders with his hand. This is a big boy in the world of kobolds, and he's moving that weight with his own magic. Earth-based blighters they are, and he knows something has to be here, even if he can't see me, because otherwise, what opened that nice symmetrical hole in the wall down the way? And if he has any sense of the presence or energy of other kobolds, he probably knows one of them abruptly got snuffed a few minutes ago. So he's not taking any chances. He didn't hear a death scream or see any blood splatter, so he's gonna throw more at me. I can see him clenching his fingers, and the wall of lava bubbling and swelling behind him. This is gonna be bad. I put the spike between me teeth and shift to a ram, the brass of me knuckles flowing up to the horns and coating them, making them unbreakable. Then I lower me head and charge straight at the kobold with all I've got, just as he sends a wide spray of molten rocks and lava in my direction. There's no avoiding it or dodging. It's like a net of fire backed with stone. My horns slam into the leading edge, breaking it apart, and that provides a sort of cone of protection, keeping it out of me eyes at least. But that doesn't mean I pass through unscathed. I get pretty feckin' scathed, in fact, especially down me back above the tail. I'm pretty sure it's just on fire and I'm melting, but I have a target to hit first. He sees the flare of my passage through his salvo, the fire burning on the outline of something indistinct, but he's still not sure what I am, except coming for him. He tries to move, but I'm both watching and much faster, and I adjust me course. I take him in the ribs, launching him off his feet and propelling him right into that wall of lava. Neither my hit nor the lava will kill him, but his advantage is all gone now. He can't stand there and throw fiery rocks at me. I skitter to the side, clear the lava's edge, and shift back to human, rolling around and away from the fire on me arse. I draw heavily on Bavaria's energy to heal me burning skin and let the spike drop into me hand. Then I wait. It's less than a minute before the lava erupts into the cavern, and had I still been standing in front of it, I would have been completely coated, beyond the help of healing. The kobold steps forth from the fire, roaring his defiance, and when nothing comes to slap him, he chuckles, assuming me dead. Well, not yet, ye smug shite. I'm hurt, and I could be consumed by fire at any moment, but I'm not out of the fight yet. Except the lava, now covering the cavern floor, does present a problem. I ask Bavaria for help once more in fashioning something useful far more quickly than I could bind it together myself. Makeshift stone sandal platforms that I bind directly to the skin of me soles, which will hopefully allow me to walk across the lava and sneak up on the rogue. That done, I check on the kobold. I'm off to his left, perhaps a tad behind his shoulder. He takes a couple of steps forward, obviously scanning the cavern for some sign of me corpse. The rumble and quake of the earth covers my whispered binding as I target a boulder across the cavern and take me first step onto the lava. Hot all around, but the stone holds. All I have to do is not trip and fall over into the slag. I step with more confidence and complete the binding, yanking that boulder on the far side right toward the lava. It begins to drag itself in that direction, and the kobold turns to face it, which means his back is to me. It's nothing but a distraction. I'm wondering if I should tap him on the shoulder to get him to face me when I realize that the eye sockets are not the only path to the brain. The kobold's ears are wee, but the left one serves. I stab the spike inside, pierce the eardrum, and scramble his brain, but good. It topples over and I back up gingerly, trying not to fall over myself and fail at winning. The shuddering of the cavern subsides, and once I'm on safe ground again, I remove the stone shields from my feet and let Bavaria know it's done.
No, three more.
Fucking hells, I mutter, and some of that sentiment must have leaked through because Bavaria adds,
smaller ones, you will win.
I'm not so sure. The burns are pretty bad, and my lungs feel permanently polluted. I can't get a proper breath, to be honest. Need clean air, I say, and the response comes quickly.
Follow.
The earth behind me moves, a new tunnel boring through the crust. Once I stagger down it a few steps, Bavaria closes off the cavern, shutting out all that sulfur. The tunnel slopes upward after that until we get near enough to the surface for some sunlight and fresh air to rain down from a hole.
Rest and heal,
Bavaria says, and I give my thanks as I take big lungfuls of fresh air and feel the pain of me burns recede somewhat. The elemental's pouring huge resources into this, which must mean it stands to lose much more if the kobolds are allowed to continue. And they are continuing. The ground beneath my own feet might be steady, but they're still shaking going on nearby. And the longer I rest, the worse off this area will be. Especially if any of that lava makes it to the surface. I take in one more deep breath and tell Bavaria I'm ready.
Harmony,
comes the reply. And the ground beneath me swells, pushing me up through the hole until I'm on the surface again. There's a buck standing there, and for a moment I think it might be Sheahan, but Bavaria puts that notion to rest quickly.
Follow animal to next tunnel site.
The buck turns and bounds through the forest to the south. I can't keep up as a human, and my wounded shoulder would hamper me if I tried to fly as a kite, so I shapeshift back to a ram and put the stake between my lips, try me best to keep pace, and wince as the burns throb anew. Makes sense to have me do this if it's going to be a goodly distance, and it is. It's miles, in fact, and there's no use spending energy to create a tunnel for me in that situation. The ground doesn't stop rumbling the whole time, and I hope Bavaria would be able to recover quickly from all this strain. I also hope no one has been hurt wherever people might be living around here. I don't think there are any huge cities in the area, but there are probably wee villages and some isolated cabins and farms, things like that. Buildings that weren't designed to withstand earthquakes. We run long enough for the burns to calm down to smoldering coals, relatively speaking, and for me lungs to feel like they're free and clear again. But the earthquake is getting worse. Honestly, they're never supposed to last this long. The ram form is a bit steadier than I would be on two legs, but even so, keeping upright is a challenge.
Hurry,
Bavaria tells me.
Almost there.
That's the truth. A tunnel opens up less than 100 yards from me, and once I get there, I shift to human and cast camouflage, alert for ambushes. But the kobold I'm ushered to is not as paranoid as the others. He's too deeply involved in manipulating the earth, and he's easy to dispatch as a result. The earthquake subsides almost immediately afterward, and the last two I'm forced to chase are simply running away when I find them, because they must have figured out that their brothers all met bad ends. I would have said they learned their lesson and let them go, but Bavaria insists that I hunt them down, and I can't say no. It wants the kobolds to know that there'll be no mercy for messing with the earth like that, but I have to pursue them underneath the mountains to their hidey holes. Hours later, when it's done and I emerge from my subterranean shenanigans on the side of some peak, I have no desire to go spelunking anymore or even try a subway. I'd rather see the sky myself. I collapse and stretch out, bathing in the sun and enjoying the fields of treetops and meadows rolling beneath me, all bonny and blithe. You are beautiful, I tell Bavaria.
Gratitude.
please visit at length. Enjoy my lands.
Harmony, I says. And I think to myself, I'd work to exhaustion every day for a view like this. There is peace to be found in unspoiled land. I don't know how unspoiled it will remain. I imagine that we're getting quite close to the world's biggest demonstration of the first law of Owen. And I worry about Greta and me apprentices, even though they should be safe in Flagstaff soon. For the first time, I wish I had one of those feckin' cell phones, just to check on them. And the next time I see Sam and Ty fighting kobolds on a screen, I'm gonna tell them their video game monsters are shite.
Chapter 11. Matini turned out to be a completely sweet person who'd rather do anything in the world than see her father or brother again. She did have a passport, and Lakshya had left her all her financial information, essentially transferring many lifetimes of wealth to Matini's care. So she was also abruptly wealthy, unbeknownst to her family. But she had no idea how to remain in Ireland legally for more than a few months, or indeed if she even wanted to remain there. We hopped into Lakshya's rental, and I drove her to Cork. "I think you'll find that money is the ultimate freedom," I said, "while the lack of it is often a prison."
"Yes, I can see the truth of that. I was dependent on my family and they were unpleasant to live with. I felt trapped."
Her face tightened in frustration before she muttered, "But I guess I'm free now." "Indeed you are. You can fly anywhere, rent a place for a few months and move on. I lived that way for centuries. Your family will never find you unless you wish it. Minimize your online footprint and always use an alias for everything. Whenever you feel the least bit nervous, fly away to the next place. And when you find some place you wish to stay, then you can take the time to arrange for a visa or permanent residence status." I took her to a bank and made sure she could successfully wire funds and remain flush for a while. Then I gave her my contact information, bid her farewell, and returned to the rental car. There was a television screen blaring in the rental car office with news of strange eruptions in Taiwan, Japan, the Bavarian Alps, and elsewhere. No solid numbers on injuries or fatalities, just unprecedented seismic activity with no warning. Seismologists and geologists were baffled. Rumors were trickling in of other wild phenomena occurring around the globe, but nothing verified yet. I wondered if these news organizations would send reporters to the scene to get live footage from the sites, and as soon as I asked myself the question, I knew the answer was yes. People sitting at home or in pubs or airports or even car rental agencies would soon be able to watch some hapless journalist planted in front of a howling madness saying, "As you can see from the utter batshit unfolding behind me, the situation is pretty dire, and I can't believe my boss sent me into the middle of this insanity. That's it, I bloody quit!"
Well, if they thought that was unusual, wait until they saw what was going to happen next in Scandinavia. It would be far more dark and dire than any Swedish crime drama.
When I'd made my first ill-fated shift to the Norse Plains, I learned that the primary tether to the world tree, Yggdrasil, was located in Sweden, to the east of Norway, as it was set down in the Eddas. But not all that far east, relatively speaking. That tether point, or I suppose I should say that root of the world tree, led straight down to the spring of Verglomir, and it was from that spot in Sweden where, if Makira's tyromancy was correct, the host of hell would emerge, and Ragnarok would begin in earnest. Makira's divination had yet to fail me. I hoped she had called Fiori by now. The tethered tree was on the shore of a small pond near Skoghall, Sweden, on the northern shore of Lake Vänern. As soon as I shifted in, I scanned the area in the magical spectrum and saw a big glowing glob of juju off to the south. That's the direction I headed, and I soon discovered it was the mustering grounds of the Fey host, and it was also a swanky 18-hole golf course.
It must have been here before, when Granuaile and I plunged through the surface of the pond with Freya, and it turned out to be a portal down to Nivelheim. But we'd sailed over it in the night, and I never realized. The pond wasn't one of the water traps of the course. It was off the course itself, just to the north of it, and probably had some kind of stream connecting it to Lake Vernern. The Fae hadn't used the same bound tree as I had. There was another one on the golf course, newly tethered, near where they were massed, and as I drew closer I saw more and more of the Fae shifting in and sorting themselves into ranks. I had no idea if they were sent by Briat or by Fand. Fand's presence would mean that Owen's mission had at least partially succeeded, but until she fought on Briat's behalf at her request, nothing was certain. I veered off to one side as I neared the host. I was still the Iron Druid, after all, and not welcome among them. My aura would destroy them on touch. I did wave to the nearest one, however, and beckon her to come forward, signaling via drawn knots in the air that I promised safety. The flying fairy inched forward cautiously, and once I felt she was in shouting distance, I held up a hand to allow her to stop in safety and listen. "Please inform the host I'm here to fight alongside the Fae, for Ireland, Tir na n'Og, and all the Fae Plains." She nodded and flitted away, and that would suffice. Word would spread quickly, and hopefully I wouldn't have to stare down a volley of arrows at any point. I settled down to wait. The unfortunate reality was that we could only react to whatever Loki manifested at this point. We couldn't plan for anything, except to be ready for his arrival, since both he and Hel were protected from divination, which meant Loki and Hel might not show up here at all. It was only the vast host of Hel and her uncountable Draugar that would appear for certain. Nothing else about the prophesied sequence of Ragnarok could be assured. I had made sure of that when I killed the Norns, and Fenris the Wolf, and Jormungandr. It was certainly a much larger show already than the original Norse conception, as I sat on the putting green of one of the holes, my meditative consultation with the elemental confirmed as much. In the African countries that comprised Yorubaland, the Orishas led by Shango were fighting the Ayogan. Ganesha and the Hindu pantheon manifested in India to beat back the surge of Rakshasas and other demons there. Flitish was in Japan, fighting alongside the Shinto deities against a flood tide of Oni. Granuaile was fighting alongside Sun Wukong against the Yama kings in Taiwan. And there were many more such conflicts, some of them arranged by Loki, but others arising because someone with a chaotic streak in their personality saw an opportunity. My meditations were interrupted by a small but extraordinary delegation from the Fae host. Fand, Munanin MacLear, and 5 large white-furred creatures hailed me and approached from the fairway leading to my green. I was pretty sure I knew who the furry folk were, but I was entirely surprised that Fand was willing to appear with them.
"Sheehan, well met," Munanin said.
I rose to my feet and smiled. "Munanin, how pleasant to see you again. And you, Fand." The Queen of the Fairies gave me the barest nod of acknowledgement, but said nothing. Her eyes did not meet mine, but rather fixated below my chin at the cold iron amulet around my neck. Even that much civility from her was probably a remarkable concession. The God of the Sea said,
"I've come to introduce you to my children, the Yeti."
These were clearly not Fan's children, but her expression was blank.
"They wanted to meet you."
"They did. The honor's mine." Munanin and Fan stepped to one side, and he introduced the tallest of the Yeti, with extraordinary braids and silver threads worked into his facial hair.
"This is the eldest, Erlander."
The Yeti broke into a wide grin and extended a huge furred hand for me to shake. I took it, and it was not unlike wrapping one's fist around an ice cube covered in felt.
"Oh, Master Sheehan, it is such a pleasure. We are great friends of your apprentice, Granuaile, and wanted to thank you for sending her to us."
"She speaks very highly of you as well." Erlander took over the responsibility of introductions, and rarely have I seen or felt such joy in a meeting. Granuela told me how wonderful the Yeti were, but in person I discovered they were not the sort of beings to which words can do justice. They were unique. Their magic combining the elemental talents of their frost giant heritage with the binding skill of druidry. Hildur, the second eldest, immediately asked me a question.
Did Granuel tell you about the hockey rink she made for us?
Yes, she did. The way their expressions lit up, it was clear that Hildur had broached a favorite subject.
It's fantastic. We dream of playing in a proper game with humans someday. Perhaps we could rival the professionals of the NHL. Do you play hockey, Master Druid?
Sadly not, but I do enjoy watching the games live and making fun of the Toronto Maple Leafs, who manage to lose all the time in spite of having an enormous budget. And please call me Atticus, no honorifics. Each of them had more to share about Granuel in the most friendly, hairy, animated terms, and before long my face began to hurt from smiling so much. Scoover asked me to relay that the ice sculpture of Jon Snow,
"He who knows nothing,"
was still standing in the Himalayas, and as far as they could tell, he still knew nothing. Isilfur hoped that he could share more of his poetry with her soon, and Adrun, the youngest and smallest of them, but still far taller than me, asked about the whirling blade they made for her.
"Is it serving her satisfactorily? We all worked on it together."
"Oh, yes. Well, unfortunately, it was stolen from her by Loki."
"Loki, the same one who is responsible for this thing we are here to stop?"
"The very same. He may have it on his person. The Yeti did something with their fur, an involuntary reaction, perhaps. It fluffed out and then flattened, their expressions turning dour."
"That is most unfortunate news,"
Erlander said. "I agree." Beneath me, the earth rumbled. We all looked north to the pond and saw that it was bubbling away, boiling into nothing. In short order, it exploded, a gout of flame rising from the center of an ever-expanding cloud of steam, and the yellow-orange center of it kept building and building as a mountain formed where a lake used to dwell, boulder-sized chunks of granite and basalt falling and oozing as a volcano formed before our eyes. But it was unaccompanied by the standard payload of ash. It was all rock and flame, the sort of clear, pure eruption Eddie Van Halen played once, the sky remaining crystal clear a sunny day for an apocalypse in Scandinavia. Atop the rising cone, a form took shape in the flame, a monstrous humanoid the height of skyscrapers, and once it solidified, a head and molten shoulders with arms of stone and a heart of bottomless rage, it erupted anew. Fountains of flame rocketing into the sky and spreading in all directions. The fire giant Surt, long confined to Muspelheim, had finally come to Midgard, and he had come to burn it all. Wounded, seething, and petty, he vented his long pent-up fury upon the world, and his fire arced like missiles to far distant lands, careless of what joy it burned down or what ruin it brought to innocent souls. The heat of him singed my face, even from such a distance, and I knew my iron amulet would be no protection against his flame should it be directed at me. Right now, however, Surt's fire was spreading vast distances, and we were standing underneath an expanding molten umbrella. So this was how the prophecy of the sirens would come true. Surt's long simmering tantrum would set the world alight, and there would be no scientific explanation possible except for the sudden eruption of a volcano where no seismic activity previously existed. Satellites would reveal the epicenter of the fire, but only we at ground level could see the figure standing in the flames. The Yeti sighed collectively, at once awed and dismayed by the power Surt displayed.
"I think that's our cue,"
Adarun said, and her elder siblings grunted in agreement. The youngest Yeti turned to Munnan and MacLear.
"We love you, father."
"And I love you. All of you."
He embraced each of them in turn, told them of his pride and hope for their safety, assured them of his confidence that they could save the world from all consuming flames. and then the Yeti stepped away, puffed out their fur again, sparkling with new crystals of frost, and froze the ground beneath their feet. They skated together toward the fire on a ribbon of ice. They were quite literally beneath Surt's notice until the last second, when their single track split into five and each Yeti crystallized their own shining path to a different part of Surt. Erlander rose highest on a pillar of rapidly melting ice toward Surt's face, and once he reached the height of his collarbone, he let loose with a tremendous blast of icicles aimed directly at the giant's eyes. That provoked a violent reaction. The gouts of flame ceased erupting upward and exploded outward instead, over our heads, into Lake Vernon and beyond, and the sky turned into a burning sheet of orange and black. The net result was that Erlander simply disappeared behind a wall of orange, and both Hildur and Skuver were consumed by globs of magma. Isildur, skating toward a knee, toppled from his ice sheet by a glancing blow, but formed a ramp down to save himself like a downhill skier. It was Adrun, skating just above ground level, that Surt failed to notice until it was too late, distracted as he was by her siblings. Using her whirling blade, she pricked one of his massive toes, an exercise of stabbing it into the edge of a lava flow. And the effect was immediate and catastrophic, even if it was too late to save the other Yeti. The towering form of Surt screeched as its soul was detached from its frame and sucked into the blade's reservoir of energy. The limbs wobbled, destabilized, and then the entire body began to come apart like orange gelatin, raining down on the mountain. Both Isildur and Adrun raced to escape the umbrellas of it, ice tracks melting behind them almost as soon as they passed. They did manage to clear the ruin, but their fur was blackened and singed in places. Surt did burn the world, fulfilling the prophecy of the sirens, but the Yeti made sure he didn't have time to burn it all down. A cautious, ragged cheer rose up among the Fey host. But it didn't last long. The portal to the Norse plain opened again, and this time the eruption was of a different kind. The undead, phantasmal Draugar boiled out of hell, armored and fearless, a horde intent on razing all that stood before them. Chapter 12. Sifu's son grips his staff so that it points at me, but rests against his left hip. A stance I've seen only a couple of times before, very briefly from Atticus, as a throwaway demonstration. "There is a style of fighting that uses this stance, with a very long and heavy staff," he said. "But that's an impractical weapon to carry around with you, so we'll skip that and focus on forms using the shorter staff you possess." The Monkey King apparently wanted me to use Skawaja in that style of fighting, and I ask him if my staff will be sufficient. He shakes his head at me.
"Wrong question. Throw away your assumptions about the coming battle. You are not going to be fighting humans. These creatures will be stronger, and you will need to use your center of gravity and the strength in your hips to move them, because they will move differently. The defenses you know will only be partially effective against them."
"What sort of creatures are we talking about?"
"Elongated arms and more than two. Razor wings. Some have tongues like frogs, but not sticky. They're stiff and pointed at the end, and they use them to pierce your body."
"Lovely. Are these Buddhist demons?"
"Some. Only some. The hells of the 10 Yama kings are a blended realm."
I squinted him, imagining a chunky demon puree. "How do you mean, blended?" He cocks his head at me, scratches his chin.
"Ah, my words fail. Take me as an example. I learned many of my tricks and skills from Taoist masters. Gradually I came to Buddhism and embraced that, but without rejecting my Taoist teachings. And many people in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China also harbor beliefs from Confucianism, all three living in the same house in harmony. Many shrines reflect this. You have an English word for this that escapes me now, this blending of faiths without conflict.
Does Sifu-san perhaps refer to religious syncretism?
He does. I mean, I do. This might be strange to you from the West, where people think you must believe only one thing, but in the East we have no problem with this.
I have no problem either, Sifu. I am a student of religion and philosophy.
Excellent. So as it is in the shrines and the heavens, so it is in the hells.
As above, so below?
Precisely. You will encounter Taoist monsters and Buddhist demons as well. You may encounter hybrids of the two, and they will not fight like anything you have seen before. So you must fight like them, a blending of styles, ignoring adherence to this form or that, and focusing instead on the pure expression of battle demanded by your shifting opponents. We will begin with this stance, but flow into other forms from here and return.
I understand now, Sifu.
Begin. Attack, and let me demonstrate the advantages of this stance.
He establishes a pattern of having me attack first from different positions, while he displays the defense and counterattack, then switching roles so that I must learn and execute the moves flawlessly as he attacks. We do this while the battle rages over Yangmingshan. He pauses when Seven Star Mountain erupts anew with an entirely different horde. It looks chunkier, larger demons, perhaps, but mixed with smaller bodies that may be human.
The second Yama King has come,
he says, and pulls out another tuft of hair, making even more copies of himself. They immediately launch themselves through the air to join battle in the north. I hear some exclamations and raised voices floating up from the streets below. People in the city are becoming aware that something untoward is happening. I'm worried about widespread panic as much as the demons, I tell him. There will be traffic accidents and tramplings and who knows what else before the demons ever get to the population.
Yes, that is the way of people who are not at peace. But we will try to keep the demons confined to Yangmingshan and minimize the loss of life.
And if we cannot?
Then a great many people will be moving on to Samsara, the Great Wheel.
Sifu, I have a question. I am able to make myself invisible due to the bindings on my staff. Will that not render these defenses pointless, since my opponents will not be able to see me?
You will be as plain to them as the sun in the sky. Your binding will not matter to them. They will not be using human eyes to look at you, after all. These creatures from the hells can pierce all veils.
Oh.
Now, concentrate. The same sequence again. Show me you have mastered it.
And he launches himself at me in a blistering fury of strikes from both low and high angles that I must defend from my middle. My instruction continues until the third Yama King arrives, and the Monkey King sends out even more clones. I'm exhausted, and my fingers are blistered and chapped from my staff. I've had no contact with the earth in all these hours, and my energy is dangerously low. I don't know how much use I'll be without some time to heal and recharge.
That is all,
Sifu-san says after his third batch of clones departs.
I can extend myself no more, and you are tired. Also, the time grows short. Let us return to the shop.
Thank you for the instructions, Sifu.
You are welcome. But I am no longer your teacher, so you may call me Wukong again.
The shop is cleared of customers when we get down there. There are only a few employees left, arguing loudly in Mandarin about something. Wukong's voice cuts through theirs and ends it. He dismisses them and they exit out to the entrance, still in their human guises, to go who knows where to enjoy the apocalypse. Wukong locks the door behind them, displays a sign that I assume means closed in Mandarin, and pulls down blinds so that no one can see us through the windows. Then he turns and grins at me.
Ready for some bubble tea?
Seriously?
A different flavor this time. Something special.
All right, Then what?
Then we go to fight at Yang Min Shan, and we live or we die.
Can you die? The Monkey King laughs, and he moves around to the tea-making station.
I admit the odds are in my favor, but I suppose it is possible. And if it does happen, well, I have a pretty good idea that my afterlife will not be so bad. How about you?
You're asking what I expect in my afterlife? My karma points or whatever?
Yes, I speak of karma.
Well, I never put my seat back when I'm flying coach, and thereby invade the space of the person behind me?
I am not sure what